Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, and our first story is Gone Fishing by James Schmitz. Ready to blast off? Here we go. Barney Chard, 37, financier, entrepreneur, occasional blackmailer, occasional con man, and very competent in all these activities, stood on a rickety wooden lake dock, squinting against the late afternoon sun, and waiting for his current business prospect to give up the pretense of being interested in trying to catch fish. The prospect, who stood a few yards farther up the dock, rod in one hand, was named Dr. Oliver B. McAllen. He was a retired physicist, though less retired than was generally assumed. A dozen years ago, he had rated as one of the country's top men in his line. And while dressed like an aging tramp, in what he had referred to as fishing togs, he was at the moment potentially the country's wealthiest citizen. There was a clandestine invention he had fathered, which he called the McAllen tube. The tube was the reason Barney Chard had come to see McAllen. Gently raising and lowering the fishing rod and blinking out over the quiet water, Dr. McAllen looked preoccupied with disturbing speculations not connected with his sport. The man had a secrecy bug. The invention, Barney thought, had turned out to be bigger than the inventor. McAllen was afraid of the tube, and in the forefront of his reflections must be the inescapable fact that the secret of the McAllen tube could no longer be kept without Barney Chard's cooperation. Barney had evidence of its existence, and didn't really need the evidence. A few hints dropped here and there would have made McAllen's 12 years of elaborate precaution quite meaningless. Ergo, McAllen must be pondering now how could one persuade Mr. Chard to remain silent. But there was a second consideration Barney had planted in the old scientist's mind. Mr. Chard, that knowledgeable man of the world, exuded, not at all by chance, the impression of great quantities of available cash. His manner, the conservatively tailored business suit, the priceless chip of a platinum watch. And McAllen needed cash badly. He'd been fairly wealthy himself at one time, but since he had refrained from exploiting the tube's commercial possibilities, his continuing work with it was exhausting his capital. At least that could be the assumed reason for McAllen's impoverishment, which was a matter Barney had established. In months, the old man would be living on beans. Ergo again, McAllen's thoughts must be running. How might one merely coax Mr. Chard into silence, but actually get him to come through with some much-needed financial support? What inducement, aside from the tube, could be offered someone in his position? Barney grinned inwardly as he snapped the end of his cigarette out on the amber-tinted water. The mark always sells himself. And McAllen was well along in the process. Polite silence was all that was necessary at the moment. He lit a fresh cigarette, feeling a mild curiosity about the little lake's location. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan seemed equally probable guesses. What mattered was that half an hour ago, McAllen's tube had brought them both here in a wink of time, from his home in California. Dr. McAllen thoughtfully cleared his throat. "Ever do any fishing, Mr. Chard?" he asked. After getting over his first shock at Barney's revelations, he'd begun speaking again in the brisk, abrupt manner Barney remembered from the last time he'd heard McAllen's voice. "No," Barney admitted, smiling, "never quite got around to it." "Always been too busy, eh? With this and that, Barney agreed. McAllen cleared his throat again. He was a roly-poly little man, over 70 now, but still healthy-looking, with an apple-cheeked, sunburned face. Over a pair of steel-rimmed glasses, his faded blue eyes peered musingly at Barney. "Around 35, aren't you?"
37.
"Married?"
"Divorced."
"Any particular hobbies?"
Barney laughed.
"I play a little golf, not very seriously."
McAllen clicked his tongue.
"Well, what do you do for fun?"
"I'd say I enjoy almost anything I get involved in." Barney, still smiling, felt a touch of wariness. He'd been expecting questions from McAllen, but not quite this kind.
"Mainly making money, eh? Well," McAllen conceded, "that's not a bad hobby. Practical, too. Just a moment."
The tip of a slender rod in his left hand dipped slightly, and 60 feet out beyond the end of the old dock, a green and white bobber began twitching about. Then the bobber suddenly disappeared. McAllen lifted the rod a foot or two with a smooth, swift motion and paused.
"Hooked," he announced, looking almost childishly pleased. The fish on the far end of the line didn't seem to put up much of a struggle, but the old man reeled it in slowly and carefully, giving out line from time to time, then taking it back. He seemed completely absorbed. Not until the fish had been worked close to the dock was there a brief minor commotion near the surface. Then McAllen was down on one knee, holding the rod high with his one hand, reaching out for his catch with the other. Barney had a glimpse of an unimpressive green and silver disc, reddish froggy eyes.
"Very nice crappie," McAllen informed him with a broad smile.
"Now," he placed the rod on the dock, reached down with his other hand. The fish's tail slapped the water. It turned sideways, was gone.
"Lost it," Barney commented, surprised.
"Huh?"
McAllen looked around. "Well, no, young man. I turned him loose. He wasn't hooked bad. Crappies have delicate lips, but I use a barbless hook. Gives them a better than a fighting chance."
He stood up with a rod, dusted the knees of his baggy slacks. "Got all the eating fish I want anyway," he added.
"You really enjoy that sport, don't you?" Barney said curiously.
McAllen advised him with the seriousness of the true devotee to try it sometime.
"I'd guess to you. It can get to be a way of living. I've been fishing since I was knee-high. 3 years ago, I figured I'd become good enough to write a book on the subject.
I got more arguments over that book. Sounder arguments, too, I'd say, than about any paper I've published in physics."
He looked at Barney a moment, still seriously, and went on.
"I told you, wetting a line would calm me down after that upset you gave me. Well, it has. Fishing is as good a form of therapy as I know about. Now, I've been doing some thinking. I'd be interested. Well, I'd like to talk some more about the tube with you, Mr. Chard, and perhaps about other things, too."
"Very gratifying to hear that, Doctor," Barney said gravely.
"I did regret having to upset you, you know."
McAllen shrugged.
"No harm done. It's given me some ideas. We'll talk right here."
He indicated the weather-beaten little cabin on the bank behind Barney.
"I'm not entirely sure about the California place. That's one reason I suggested this trip."
"You feel your houseman there mightn't be entirely reliable?"
"Frederick's unreliable? Heavens, no! He knows about the tube, of course, but Frederick expects me to invent things. It wouldn't occur to him to talk to an outsider. He's been with me for almost 40 years.
"He was," remarked Barney, "listening in on the early part of our conversation today."
"Well, he'll do that," McAllen agreed. "He's very curious about anyone who comes to see me, but otherwise... No, it's just that in these days of sophisticated listening devices, one shouldn't ever feel too sure of not being overheard."
"True enough. Barney glanced up at the cabin. "What makes you so sure of it here, Doctor?"
"No reason why anyone would go to the trouble," McAllen said. "The property isn't in my name, and the nearest neighbor lives across the lake. I never come here except by the tube, so I don't attract any attention."
He led the way along the dock. Barney Chard followed, eyes reflectively on the back of McAllen's sunburned neck and the wisp of unclipped white hair sticking out beneath his beaked fishing cap. Barney had learned to estimate accurately the capacity for physical violence in people he dealt with. He would have offered long odds that neither Dr. McAllen nor Fredericks, the elderly colored man of all work, had the capacity. But Barney's right hand slid idly into the pocket of his well-tailored coat and rested on a 25-caliber revolver. This was, after all, a very unusual situation. The human factors in themselves were predictable. Human factors were Barney's specialty. But here they were involved with something unknown. The McAllen tube. When it was a question of his personal safety, Barney Chard preferred to take no chances at all. From the top of the worn wooden steps leading up to the cabin, he glanced back at the lake. It occurred to him there should have been at least a suggestion of unreality about that placid body of water, and the sun low and red in the west beyond it. Not that he felt anything of the kind, but less than an hour ago, they had been sitting in McAllen's home in Southern California, and beyond the olive-green window shades, it had been bright daylight.
"But I can't, I really can't imagine." Dr. McAllen had just finished bumbling his round face, a study of controlled dismay on the other side of the desk. "Whatever could have brought you to these extraordinary conclusions, young man?"
Barney had smiled reassuringly, leaning back in his chair. "Well, indirectly, sir, as the pictures indicate, we might say it was your interest in fishing. You see, I happened to notice you on Mallorca last month." By itself, the chance encounter on the island had seemed only moderately interesting. Barney was sitting behind the wheel of an ancient automobile, near a private home in which a business negotiation of some consequence was being conducted. The business under discussion happened to be Barney's, but it would have been expedient for him to attend the meeting in person. Waiting for his associates to wind up the matter, he was passing time by studying an old man who was fishing from a small boat offshore, 100 yards or so below the road. After a while, the old fellow brought the boat in, appeared a few minutes later along the empty lane, carrying his tackle and an apparently empty gunny sack, and trudged unheedingly past the automobile and its occupant. As he went by, Barney had a sudden sense of recognition. Then in a flash his mind jumped back 12 years. Dr. Oliver B. McAllen. 12 years ago, the name had been an important one in McAllen's field. Then it was not so much forgotten as deliberately buried. Working under government contract at one of the big universities, McAllen had been suddenly and quietly retired. Barney, who had a financial interest in one of the contracts, had made inquiries. He was likely to be out of money if McAllen had been taken from the job. Eventually, he was informed in strict confidence that Dr. McAllen had flipped. Under the delusion of having made a discovery of tremendous importance, he had persuaded the authorities to arrange a demonstration. When the demonstration ended in complete failure, McAllen angrily accused some of his most eminent colleagues of having sabotaged his invention and withdrew from the university. To protect a once great scientist's name, the matter was being hushed up. So Mallorca was where the addled old physicist had elected to end his days. Not a bad choice, either, Barney had thought, gazing after the retreating figure. Pleasant island and a beautiful sea. He remembered having heard about McAllen's passion for angling. A day later, the Mallorca business profitably concluded. Barney flew back to Los Angeles. That evening, he entertained a pair of tanned and shapely ladies, whose idea of high fun was to drink all night and go deep-sea fishing at dawn. Barney shuddered inwardly at the latter notion, but promised to see the sporting characters to the Sweetwater Beach Municipal Pier in time to catch a party boat, and did so. One of the girls, he noticed, not without satisfaction, he'd become a little tired of the two before morning, appeared to turn a delicate green as she settled herself into the gently swaying half-day boat beside the wharf. Barney waved them an amiable farewell and was about to go, when he noticed a plump old man sitting in the stern of the boat, among other anglers, rigging up his tackle. Barney checked sharply and blinked. He was looking at Oliver B. McAllen again. It was almost a minute before he felt sure of it this time. Not that it was impossible for McAllen to be sitting in that boat, but it did seem extremely unlikely. McAllen didn't look in the least like a man who could afford nowadays to commute by air between the Mediterranean and California. And Barney felt something else trouble him obscurely as he stared down at the old scientist. A notion of some kind was stirring about in the back corridors of his mind, but refused to be drawn to view just then. He was aware of what it was while he watched the party boat head out to sea a few minutes later, smiled at what seemed an impossibly fanciful concoction of his unconscious, and started towards the pier's parking lot. But when he had reached his car, climbed in, turned on the ignition, and lit a cigarette, the notion was still with him, and Barney was no longer smiling. Fanciful it was, extremely so. Impossible in the strict sense, it was not. The longer he played it around, the more he began to wonder whether his notion mightn't hold water after all. If there was anything to it, he had run into one of the biggest deals in history. Later, Barney realized he would still have let the matter drop if it hadn't been for other things, having nothing to do with Dr. McAllen. He was between operations at present. His time wasn't occupied. Furthermore, he'd been aware lately that ordinary operations had begun to feel flat. The kick of putting over a deal, even on some other hard, bright character of his own class, unaccountably was fading. Barney Chard was somewhat frightened because the operator game was the only one he'd ever found interesting. The other role of well-heeled playboy wasn't much more than a manner of killing time. At 37, he was realizing he was bored with life. He didn't like the prospect. Now here was something which might again provide him with some genuine excitement. It could be simply his imagination working overtime, but it wasn't going to do any harm to find out. Mind humming with pleased, though still highly skeptical, speculations, Barney went back to the boat station and inquired when the party boat was due to return. He was waiting for it, well out of sight, as it came chugging up to the wharf some hours later. He had never had anything to do directly with Dr. McAllen, so the old man wouldn't recognize him. But he didn't want to be spotted by his two Amazons who might feel refreshed enough by now to be ready for another tour of the town. He needn't have worried. The ladies barely made it to the top of the stairs. They phoned for a cab and were presently whisked away. Dr. McAllen, meanwhile, also had made a telephone call and settled down not far from Barney to wait. A small gray car, 5 or 6 years old, but of polished and well-tended appearance, trundled presently up to the pier, came into the turnaround at the boat station and stopped. A thin old Negro with hair as white as the doctor's held the door open for McAllen. The car moved unhurriedly off with them. The automobile's license number produced Dr. McAllen's California address for Barney a short while later. The physicist lived in Sweetwater Beach, 15 minutes' drive from the pier, in an old Spanish-type house back in the hills. The chauffeur's name was John Emanuel Fredericks. He had been working for McAllen for an unknown length of time. No one else lived there. Barney didn't bother with further details about the Sweetwater Beach establishment at the moment. The agencies he usually employed to dig up background information were reasonably trustworthy, but he wanted to attract no more attention than was necessary to his interest in Dr. McAllen. That evening, he took a plane to New York. Physicist Frank Elby was a few years older than Barney, an acquaintance since their university days. Elby was ambitious, capable, slightly dishonest. On occasion, he provided Barney with contraband information for which he was generously paid. Over lunch, Barney broached a business matter which would be financially rewarding to both of them and should not burden Elby's conscience unduly. Elby reflected and agreed. The talk became more general. Presently, Barney remarked, "Ran into an old acquaintance of ours the other day. Remember Dr. McAllen?" "Oliver B. McAllen, naturally. Haven't heard about him in years. What's he doing?" Barney said he had only seen the old man, hadn't spoken to him, but he was sure it was McAllen. "Where was this?" Elby asked. "Sweetwater Beach, small town down the coast." Elby nodded. "That must have been McAllen. That's where he had his home. He was looking hale and hearty. They didn't actually institutionalize him at the time of his retirement, did they?" "Oh, no, no reason for it. Except on the one subject of that cockeyed invention of his, he behaved perfectly normally. Besides, he would have hired a lawyer and fought any such move. He had plenty of money, and nobody wanted publicity. McAllen was a pretty likable old boy." "The university never considered taking him back?" Elby laughed. "Well, hardly. After all, man, a matter transmitter." Barney felt an almost electric thrill of pleasure. "Right on the nose, Brother Chard, right on the nose." He smiled. "What's that, what it was supposed to be? I never was told all the details." Elby said that for the few who were informed of the details, it had been a 7-day circus. McAllen's reputation was such that more people, particularly on his staff, had been ready to believe him than were ready to admit it later. When he left, you know, he never even bothered to take that transmitter along. The thing was taken apart and checked over as carefully as if somebody thought it might still suddenly start working. It was absolute Goldberg, of course. The old man has simply gone off his rocker. Hadn't there been any indication of it before? Not that I know of, except that he'd been dropping hints about his gadget for several months before he showed it to anyone, Elby said indifferently. The talk turned to other things. The rest was routine, not difficult to carry out. A small cottage on Mallorca, near the waterfront, was found to be in McAllen's name. McAllen's liquid assets were established to have dwindled to something less than those of John Emanuel Fredericks, who patronized the same local bank as his employer. There had been frequent withdrawals of large irregular sums throughout the past years. The withdrawals were not explained by McAllen's frugal personal habits. Even his fishing excursions showed an obvious concern for expense. The retention of the Mediterranean retreat, modest though it was, must have a reason beyond simple self-indulgence. Barney arranged for the rental of a bungalow in the outskirts of Sweetwater Beach, which lay uphill from the old house in which McAllen and Fredericks lived, and provided a good view of the residence and its street entry. He didn't go near the place himself. operatives of a Los Angeles detective agency, went on constant watch in the bungalow with orders to photograph the two old men in the other house and any visitors at every appearance, and to record the exact times the pictures were taken. At the end of each day, the photographs were delivered to an address from where they promptly reached Barney's hands. A European agency was independently covering the Mallorca cottage in the same manner. Nearly 4 weeks passed before Barney obtained the exact results he wanted. He called off the watch at both points, and the next day came up the walk to McAllen's home and rang the doorbell. John Fredericks appeared, studied Barney's card, and Barney, with an air of mild disapproval, and informed him that Dr. McAllen did not receive visitors. "So I've been told," Barney acknowledged pleasantly. "Please be so good as to give the doctor this." Frederick's white eyebrows lifted by the barest trifle as he looked at the sealed envelope Barney was holding out. After a moment's hesitation, he took it, instructed Barney to wait, and closed the door firmly. Listening to Frederick's footsteps receding into the house, Barney lit a cigarette and was pleased to find that his hands were as steady as if he had been on the most ordinary of calls. The envelope contained two sets of photographs dated and indicating the time of day. The date was the same for both sets. The recorded time showed the pictures had been taken within 15 minutes of one another. The central subject in each case was Dr. McAllen, sometimes accompanied by Fredericks. One set of photographs had been obtained on Mallorca, the other in Sweetwater Beach at McAllen's house. Bearing rocket assists, the two old men had been documented as the fastest-moving human beings in all history. Several minutes passed before Fredericks reappeared, with a face which was now completely without expression. He invited Barney to enter and conducted him to McAllen's study. The scientist had the photographs spread out on a desk before him. He gestured at them. "Just what, if anything, is this supposed to mean, sir?" he demanded in an unsteady voice. Barney hesitated, aware that Fredericks had remained in the hall just beyond the study. But Fredericks obviously was in McAllen's confidence. His eavesdropping could do no harm. "It means this, doctor," Barney began amiably enough, and he proceeded to tell McAllen precisely what the photographs meant. McAllen broke in protestingly two or three times, then let Barney conclude his account of the steps he had taken to verify his far-fetched hunch on the pier without further comment. After a few minutes, Barney heard Frederick's steps moving away, and then a door closing softly somewhere, and he shifted his position a trifle so that his right side was now toward the hall door. The little revolver was in the right-hand coat pocket. Even then, Barney had no real concern that McAllen or Fredericks would attempt to resort to violence. But when people are acutely disturbed, and McAllen at least was, almost anything can happen. When Barney finished, McAllen stared down at the photographs again, shook his head, and looked over at Barney. "If you don't mind," he said, blinking behind his glasses, "I should like to think about this for a minute or two." "Of course, doctor," Barney said politely. McAllen settled back in the chair, removed his glasses, and half closed his eyes. Barney let his gaze rove. The furnishings of the house were what he had expected. Well tended, old, declining here and there to the downright shabby. The only reasonably new piece in the study was a radio phonograph. The walls of the study and of the section of a living room he could see through a small archway were lined with crammed bookshelves. At the far end of the living room was a curious collection of clocks in various types and sizes, mainly antiques, but also some odd metallic pieces with modernistic faces. Vacancies in the rows indicated Frederick's might have begun to dispose discreetly of the more valuable items on his employer's behalf. McAllen cleared his throat, finally opened his eyes, and settled the spectacles back on his nose. "Mr. Chard," he inquired, "have you had scientific training?"
"No."
"Then," said McAllen, "the question remains of what your interest in the matter is. Perhaps you'd like to explain just why you put yourself to such considerable expense to intrude on my personal affairs."
Barney hesitated perceptibly.
"Doctor," he said, "there is something tantalizing about an enigma. I'm fortunate in having the financial means to gratify my curiosity when it's excited to the extent it was here."
McAllen nodded.
"I can understand curiosity. Was that your only motive?"
Barney gave him his most disarming grin.
"Frankly, no. I've mentioned I'm a businessman." McAllen said, frowning. "Don't misunderstand me. One of my first thoughts, admittedly, was that here were millions waiting to be picked up. But the investigation soon made a number of things clear to me."
"What were they?"
"Essentially, that you had so sound a reason for keeping your invention a secret that to do it, you were willing to ruin yourself financially and to efface yourself as a human being and as a scientist."
"I don't feel," McAllen observed mildly, "that I have really effaced myself, either as a human being or as a scientist."
"No, but as far as the public was concerned, you did both." McAllen smiled briefly. "That stratagem was very effective. Until now."
"Very well, Mr. Chard, you understand clearly that under no circumstances would I agree to the commercialization of,
well, of my matter transmitter?"
Barney nodded. "Of course."
"And you are still interested?"
"Very much so."
McAllen was silent for a few seconds, biting reflectively at his lower lip.
"Very well," he said again. "You were speaking of my predilection for fishing. Perhaps you'd care to accompany me on a brief fishing trip."
"Now?" Barney asked.
"Yes, now. I believe you understand what I mean. I see you do. Then if you'll excuse me for a few minutes."
Barney couldn't have said exactly what he expected to be shown. His imaginings had run in the direction of a camouflage vault beneath McAllen's house, some massively walled place with machinery that powered the matter transmitter purring along the walls, and perhaps something in the style of a plastic diving bell as the specific instrument of transportation. The actual experience was quite different. McAllen returned shortly, having changed into the familiar outdoor clothing. Apparently he had been literal about going on a fishing trip. Barney accompanied the old physicist into the living room and watched him open a small but very sturdy wall safe. Immediately behind the safe door, an instrument panel had been built in the opening. Peering over the spectacles, McAllen made careful adjustments on two sets of small dials and closed and locked the safe again.
"Now, if you'll follow me, Mr. Chard."
He crossed the room to a door, opened it, and went out. Barney followed him into a small room with rustic furnishings and painted wooden walls. There was a single, heavily curtained window. The room was rather dim.
"Well," McAllen announced, "here we are."
It took a moment for that to sink in. Then, his scalp prickling eerily, Barney realized he was standing farther from the wall than he had thought. He looked around and discovered there was no door behind him now, either open or closed. He managed a shaky grin.
"So, that's how your matter transmitter works." Well, McAllen said thoughtfully, of course it isn't really a matter transmitter. I call it the McAllen tube. Even an educated layman must realize that one can't simply dissemble a living body at one point, reassemble it at another, and expect life to resume. And there are other considerations.
Where are we? Barney asked. On Mallorca?
No, we haven't left the continent, just the state. Look out the window and see for yourself.
McAllen turned to a built-in closet, and Barney drew back the window hangings. Outside was a grassy slope uncut and yellowed by the summer sun. The slope dropped sharply to a quiet lakefront framed by dark pines. There was no one in sight, but a small wooden dock ran out onto the lake. At the far end of the dock, an old rowboat lay tethered. And, quite obviously, it was no longer the middle of a bright afternoon. The air was beginning to dim, to shift towards evening. Barney turned to find McAllen's mild, speculative eyes on him, and saw the old man had put a tackle box and fishing rod on the table.
"Your disclosures disturb me more than you may have realized," McAllen remarked by way of explanation. His lips twitched in the shadow of a smile. "At such times I find nothing quite so soothing as to drop a line into the water for a while. I've got some thinking to do, too. So let's get down to the dock. There ought to be a little bait left in the minnow-pail."
When they returned to the cabin some time later, McAllen was in a pensive mood. He started a pot of coffee in the small kitchen, then quickly cleaned the tackle and put it away. Barney sat at the table, smoking and watching him, but made no attempt at conversation. McAllen poured the coffee, produced sugar and powdered milk, and settled down opposite Barney. He said abruptly,
"Have you had any suspicions about the reason for the secretive mumbo-jumbo?"
"Yes," Barney said, "I've had suspicions, but it wasn't until that happened," he waved his hand at the wall out of which they appeared to have stepped, "that I came to a definite conclusion."
"Eh?" McAllen's eyes narrowed suddenly. "What was the conclusion?"
"That you've invented something that's really a little too good."
"Too good," said McAllen. "Go on."
"It doesn't take much power to operate the thing, does it?"
"Not," said McAllen dryly, "if you're talking about the kind of power one pays for."
"I am. Can the McAllen tube be extended to any point on Earth?"
"I should think so."
"And you financed the building of this model yourself? Not very expensive. If the secret leaked out, I'd never know who was going to materialize in my home at any time, would I? Or with what intentions?"
"That," McAllen nodded, "is about the size of it."
Barney crushed out his cigarette, lit a fresh one, blew out a thin streamer of smoke. "Under the circumstances," he remarked, "it's unfortunate you can't get the thing shut off again, isn't it?" McAllen was silent for some seconds.
"So, you finally guessed that, too," he said. "What mistake did I make?"
"None that I know of," Barney said. "But you're doing everything you can to keep the world from learning about the McAllen tube. At the same time, you've kept it in operation, which made it just a question of time before somebody else noticed something was going on, as I did. Your plans for the thing appear to have gone wrong." McAllen was nodding glumly.
"They have," he said. "They have, Mr. Chard. Not irreparably wrong, but still..." He paused. "The first time I activated the apparatus," he said, "I directed it only at two points, both of them within structures which were and are my property. It was fortunate I did so."
"That was this cabin and the place on Mallorca?"
"Yes. The main operational sections of the tube are concealed about my California home, but certain controls have to be installed at any exit point to make it possible to return. It wouldn't be easy to keep those hidden in any public place. It wasn't until I compared the actual performance of the tube with my theoretical calculations that I discovered there was an unforeseen factor involved. To make it short, I could not, to use your phrasing, shut the tube off again. But that would certainly involve some extremely disastrous phenomena at three different points of our globe.
Explosions? Barney asked.
Well, McAllen said judiciously, implosions might come a little closer to describing the effect. The exact term isn't contained in our vocabulary, and I'd prefer it not to show up there, at least in my lifetime. But you see my dilemma, don't you? If I asked for help, I revealed the existence of the tube. Once its existence was known, the research that produced it could be duplicated. As you concluded, it isn't really too difficult a device to construct. And even with the present problem solved, the McAllen tube is just a little too dangerous a thing to be at large in our world today.
You feel the problem can be solved?
Oh, yes.
McAllen took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes.
That part of it is only a matter of time. At first, I thought I'd have everything worked out within 3 or 4 years. Unfortunately, I badly underestimated the expense of some of the required experimentation, and that's what's delayed everything.
I see. I had been wondering, Barney admitted, why a man with something like this on his mind would be putting in quite so much time fishing.
McAllen grinned. Enforced idleness. It's been very irritating, really, Mr. Chard. I've been obliged to proceed in the most inexpensive manner possible, and that meant very slowly.
Barney said, if it weren't for the question of funds, how long would it take to wind up the operation?
1 year. Perhaps 2 years, McAllen shrugged. It's very difficult to be too exact, but it certainly wouldn't be longer than 2.
And what would be the financial tab?
McAllen hesitated. 1 million is the bottom figure, I'm afraid. It should run closer to 1.5 million.
Doctor, Barney said, let me make you a proposition. Join me next week for part 2 of Gone Fishing by James Schmitz. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.